Because the fluid druid is back. He is going to tell us a story, and in an unusual move of non-alliteration, the title of his story is Pondering the Douglas Fir Stump. Brock Dolman.
So should we just turn all the lights off and I can just do this in the dark and get rid of my papers? Would that be so fun? We could. Well, the light, yeah, hearing's not light. I mean, maybe some of you hear light, but that's kinesthesia. Wow, well, I've been having so much fun to first off with Betsy starting off there and the fact that I did get to journey with her to Tibet there. And in fact, a couple of those photos were actually ones that I was able to take and offer up to the cause, so to be there. And then to get to go to Ecuador, where I spent a year in 1987 and actually spent quite a bit of time on the Napo River and Puyo and the Pastaza and Huarani territory and such. And then to get to go to Yellowstone, which is my home turf on the Henry's Fork of the Snake and Yellowstone. So I'm just feeling like just like a global little junior Darwin overachiever, specialized generalist who's connected everywhere. Yeah, you could dim those guys. Bring them down. Bring it down. Bring it down. So here we go. You may take a little nocturnal stroll and allow your owl eyes to open up. For maybe in the daylight, you have been strolling in the woods, and there before you, in a forest that had been clear-cut in the past, and trees had sprung back up, and yet the legacy of various stumps were still about. If they were redwoods, unusual for conifers, they would have stumps sprouted again, and there would be this famous fairy ring where the original big mother tree was once before. But when other conifers, such as pines, or in this case, Douglas fir, and I thank Wendy for bringing us so much yummy Douglas fir tips today, but the tips are only the tip of the Douglas fir iceberg there. And it's really this thing where if you've walked in the forest and you've seen a Douglas fir stump, many of them, if they've been dead for some decades, will have rotted away and they've broken down and their carbon has gone back and maybe a little animal pooped a huckleberry on them and now there's a huckleberry growing out of the stump, and that's a good thing as well. But have any of you noticed, actually, on occasion you may run into a stump that's sitting there that has this quizzical shape about it. It actually has living tissue growing up all sides of it. And the living tissue, where once the rings of the tree were cut and open in that circular form, are slowly enclosing or may have been enclosed into a sphincter-like shape, more like a belly button of living tissue on a stump that we're accustomed to with Douglas fir of being dead because we think Douglas fir is an individual tree that dies when you cut it. So I'll leave you with that to ponder that stump speech for a moment, because what it takes me to is in thinking about a lot over the years, and I'm okay in the dark. You guys can bring it up here. I don't need the papers. Is really I've been having the blessing more recently of collaborating with my sweetie Carrie Brady in her work in Ecology Waking Way Too Much Light. Oh, dude, my eyes are like so big and open, and I, and her collaborative work with, we've heard of Brian Swim today and his work with Mary Evelyn Tucker and the Journey of the Universe, and Nature and Eros. Yeah, Earth Hour, Earth Hour. I don't know how you spell hour, but it's our Earth. So O-U-R. Let's cut. No, I'm serious. His light is gnarly. Is really thinking about this. When you're with trees and you're with old trees and you're with big trees, you get to think about time. And we saw some cryptomeria today in Japan, and we got to think about ancient coast redwoods or the giant redwoods of the Sierra or maybe bristle cones, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 year old trees. And that's deep time. 4,000 years is a long time ago, and it was fun to see Diana standing there next to the big tree with all the little markers in Big Basin on the redwood. But truly deep time, really? So when you look at this Journey of the Universe stuff and you talk about and you listen to, oh, there's a 14 billion year unfurling of time, this origin story, this allurement of the universe over the last 14 billion years. And then this moment shows up where, la, this little, right, the perfect little rock, the Goldilocks rock that's not too close to the sun and just not too far away, planet water, 4.5 billion years ago, with a B, billion years ago, shows up and does this loop-y-loop. And it does it for about 700 million years, coalescing and off-gassing and volcanism and things. And then something called life shows up 3.8 billion years ago, according to our current fossil record. This thing called life shows up. And it's a little single cell of a thing called bacteria. And these little bacteria are doing their gig from 3.8 billion almost for 1.8 billion years, almost 2 billion years. There's no other life form on the planet but little bacteria. And these critters figure out how to game that nuke plant that's 493 million miles away that takes 8 minutes to send down a photon to us. They figure out how to convert sunlight into sugar. Amazing, right? So these things, right, cyanobacteria, talking about color, these blue-green algae, and they figure that out. And the flatulence of these organisms is something called oxygen. And for 1.5 billion years, free oxygen is building up in the atmosphere, and there's nothing that's utilizing it in the other realms of life yet. And the oxygen, interestingly enough, it begins to build up. And so when we think about oxygen in the atmosphere, 21% of it is just the right amount. If it was 19%, we couldn't host a fire. If it was 23%, the planet would burn up. This really fascinating thing where the presence of oxygen within this Gaianistic orb is 100% endogenous in its origin from bacteria, every bit of it. And then all of a sudden life figures this game out where another form shows up and you get a eukaryotic cell from a prokaryotic cell where you get a nucleus and these little things called protists, slime molds, the kelp forest, kelp, imagine algae. Algae are unicellular eukaryotic multinucleated organisms with endosymbionts in them. In the case of chloroplasts, that can fix sunlight and turn it into sugar, and these characters start floating around, and some of them, in the moment, there's so much oxygen out there that what happens when you have too much oxidization out there? Things rust. And I know Neil Young told us rust never sleeps, but for 1.5 billion years, it was really active. And rust was rusting the planet and all of the material, the mineralization. And 90% of the iron ore that we have mined in the modern industrial world of iron came from the deposition of life that rusted the planet and settled a sediment out. We've been mining bacterial iron sediments for all the iron from a period before life figured out to say, well, oxygen's not so bad. Sure, we can consume oxygen through respiration and spit out CO2. And then all of a sudden, these other critters are like, damn, we need some CO2 and we'll give you oxygen. And the grand deal kicked in. And the fungus and the animals, who had mitochondria within them, started figuring out this thing of called respiration. And then the photosynthesis respiration collaborative metabolism between oxygen and CO2 kicked off. And that was about 1.2 billion years ago. And then these little dinky critters, multicellular little small things floated around out there in the primordial ooze. And then about 450 million, 500 million years ago, some of those things landed on this thing called land, terrestrial. And these little algaes and these little pre-animal-like things showed up. And then all of a sudden, plants show up. And imagine, so when we're talking about trees here, and we get in ultimately to the ability to move through little things like bryophytes and mosses, non-vascular plants, that then move into the Carboniferous era, where you get these big ferns and all these crazy equisetums, that then, because there wasn't life to break down the carbon, it built up. And voila, we get the fossil fools upon which we are extracting, foisted upon thee by the oligarchy now. But that's depositional plant material that was gathering from sunlight to sugar to soil for millions of years. And then these other things, and amazing trees, trees, trees. Are you kidding me? You tell me how a thing can actually stand up in the wind as tall as a redwood or a Douglas fir and be full of green leaves and sunlight catching little solar panels with lichens and branches and blow around and not fall over, although some do. And that's amazing. It's amazing to think about a tree. And yet all of the chloroplasts in every cell of every redwood and Doug fir and cryptomeria originated as a bacteria that figured this game out 2.5 billion years ago, right? And if you take a human and you dehydrate us because we're mostly water and you get to our dry weight after you get rid of the water weight, half of the dry weight of you bipedal sacs of saline solution that have now been desiccated, half of your dry weight is mitochondria, which is an endosymbiont of an earlier organism that was a bacteria, that it has its own nuclear DNA, and it runs its own show, and it reproduces at its own timeline, and you're called a human. Really? And we think we're individuals. But the fetish of individuation is this bizarre modern neural neuroses, that we have the fallacy of individuation when what we do understand is that the collaboration, that cooperation is the very basis of survival. And in fact, the presence of life and the immortality of life, starting with bacteria till now, has not been in individuals, but the collective presence of life begetting life, begetting life, creating conditions conducive for life on planet water where life is endemic in the known universe. This is really good. As a biologist, it's super good. Because why would I go to the moon or Mars in a lifeless place and I'd be unemployed, right? And yet we have too much fixation on biology, which is those people that spell biology, B-U-Y, the study of buying things, and that's the wrong biology. And economics has got to reclaim its original oikos from home, from oikos and oikosology, the study of home, oikos nomia, economics, the study of household management. And we've been mismanaging our household, of Earth's household, because of a fetish on the commodification of these fascinating little paper currencies. So how is it then that I'm walking in the forest, in a clear-cut over forest that's grown back, and there's a stump of a tree that by all measures, when you cut it, dies as an individual Doug fir, that there are stumps that have living tissue on them, that have grown back, yet their solar sugar system was clear cut off the top. They're not photosynthesizing. How does it work? And then what we know is that the individual fir is not an individual, and that the healing over of the sphincter-like spherical wound-covering tissue of this cambium layer is actually from the tree adjacent to it, sealing a wound in itself as a whole system, because underground there's a relationship between the bacteria and the fungus that are sharing minerals and water and sugar in a collaborative and convivial coniferous container of co-creation. And when you cut the one, the other seals. And in fact, it's all one forest. And so the ability to see the forest for the trees is really the opportunity to see the collective whole above and below in all four directions, of how it is that earth and air and fire and water create life and symbioses, symbiogenesis. Look at Lynn Margulis, if anyone wants to really study. One of the great, great thinkers of our time, Lynn Margulis, right? Yeah. Dorian Sagan. Carl Sagan, Lynn Margulis have a kid, Dorian Sagan. Oh my God, talk about big brain. Dorian's amazing, right? How is it that ultimately these folks come together and we collectively to see the fact that it's a kincentric world, and we share relations with bacteria, with animals, with plants, with fungus, and with the algae, all in one, because we're all one life. And so with that, I wish you all a blessed life together.
And the other question that I'm sure is on your mind is, what did the coyote find in the forest on the equinox? Yeah. And here to answer that question is Carolyn Casey.
Well, coyotes are quite disobedient, so my short talk has nothing to do with that. We are right now, 30 minutes before the exact equinox, right? So at 9:31 p.m. will be the exact equinox, when one metaphor hands the baton to the next, so it's perfect. So we're backstage, perfectly here. Coyote likes to say, we are the molecules with which the big story converses through the agency of synchronicity. So how splendid to be here right now backstage. And we call backstage the green room. Does anybody know why? Everything has meaning if we go back far enough, etymologically and everything. So we call backstage the green room. It's from Greek theater. It was called the green room because it was sacred to Dionysus, the green man. So every actor, regardless of their role, villain or hero, would spend time backstage in the green room dedicating themselves to the flora and fauna of this earth before they went on stage. So here we are in the green room. What is unique to our species aside from our rudeness, we often wonder. And it might be, we posit, you know, that it is part of our capacity and responsibility to borrow qualities of intelligence from our flora fauna kin. So from all the beautiful, you know, parts of our collective dream speaking, you know, the models of leadership derived from nature, one of my favorites is wolf, because I lived with a part wolf for a long time, and I live with Stella Coyote, whose father was a full-grown coyote, and she will turn 18 on Easter. So she sends her regards and some of her fur. And it's intriguing that also, just the astrological language, Saturn, which is responsibility, is trining Uranus, which is wildness and ingenuity and trickster. So right now, nature's adoptable ingenuity, because we've set so much in motion, so much rudeness, that everything's going to have to collaborate. Everybody's quality of trickster ingenuity. So I love that what's happening now, especially the new species called the Eastern Coyote, it's a hybrid wolf coyote with some dog DNA in it. So wolves, I learned from Captain Moondog Wolfie and also Michael Fox working for the Humane Society, wolves' model of leadership, wolves don't operate on dominance, they operate on charisma. And in wolf culture, charisma means who initiates play best. Now, it's not just play, it's let's go hunting and do all that, but play is really their top criterion. And wolves, even though they are hunted and even though they must hunt, they play every 30 minutes. You know, and you can tell the alpha wolf within 10 days of birth because it's the wolf pup with the lowest resting heartbeat. So it's the coolest, calmest wolf who engages the playful ingenuity of the pack. And I go, now that's a leadership model we might vote for. And because we are syncretizers, I like syncretizing it with goose, because lead goose rotates, right? Because the lead goose has taken the flak. So I like rotational wolf model. And then everybody bring up, you know, define leadership. So the words, again, if we take words back, they reveal themselves. So, you know, using the word privilege means private law. It's like, there you have it, you know. But our word inaugurate, right, inaugurate comes from the augur, which means the diviner. So the diviner part of each one of us would walk out into nature, read nature's patterns, whereby would be revealed the most responsible human steward, or wolf, possibly, and then they would be inaugurated. So this season of danger, you know, we are inaugurating a guiding story, and it's global. You know, and so we're our candidate, really, we're electing flora fauna. I mean, that's really our... I think you can make a bumper sticker. You know, Flora Fauna 2016, right? And we're defining the task. And it's also, you know, we want to inhale it. I go, you know, so many things are going on in this election cycle, and this beautiful language of astrology invites everybody to think of their lives as though it were a spiritual detective novel, in which each quirky affinity, each richness of cultural heritage, you know, all of it, the befoiblement and the blessings are all clues as to the gifts we have to contribute. Who brought what to this party? You know? So I was raised in Washington, D.C. in a political family. You know, my dad was, you know, 54 when I was born. He was a New Deal congressman under Roosevelt, New Deal guy. So I grew up with power-possessing political beings in the House in which, you know, we'd go, they're not that smart. So I was disabused of the glamour of power kind of early, but trained to bring metaphysics even to the into the political realm and even to the intelligent, you know, even into the academic realm. So this wedding, this re-wedding, I so love, you know, Diana as an embodiment. The wedding of science wedded back to mythology and compassion and mythology and heart is exactly what wants to go on now. It's part of our assignment. So, you know, we are assigned the task of getting illusorily estranged things, you know, to wed together once again. So it's not heart or intellect, you know. It's like, no, they love each other. That's a false estrangement. It's not science or mythology. No, they love each other. These are false estrangements brokered by the reality police to render people obedient to external authority. Until now. Because one of the qualities of Coyote is Coyote loves to toss lightning at the story circle, you know, and turn the closed-loop circle into a spiral. So here we are getting close to this equinox, and I love how Diana opened this conference, because you are a Sun-Pluto conjunction in Leo. She's a perfect combination of grand dame in service to trickster. And part of the dynamic of equinox, you know, is that for 25 to 30,000 years, people have gathered now, right? And it's the form of the death and resurrection show. It's the earliest form of meaningful theater in which people would call in, invite power. We don't source power, we invite it. And dedicated gatherings and dedicated acts of beauty invite power into the world. And so what's going on at equinoxes all over the world, you know, is where the literal and symbolic light of the sun illumines the writing or the painting at the back of the cave. And what is that? It's like, come on in, power. You know, and here, you know, animate this story, right? This is our guiding story. So it's a crucial dynamic that we don't source power, we invite it. You know, and again, Diana really called it in. I mean, she was like, all right, imagine putting her foot in a straight, and I go, that's so great. You know, that is just right. That is just what wants to happen, to call it in. Because we don't source power, again, we invite it. And the modern world's part of its giant kerfuffle, you know, is that it is mistaken dominance and control for power. And in the astrological language, Pluto says dominance is the toxic mimic of power. Let go of control so power can come on in. We magnetize and we animate. So what's going on right now as we've convened at the end of this incredibly rich, you know, we're at the very last degree of the zodiac right now. The sun is at the very last degree of the zodiac. Each planet in this beautiful language represents a quality of living intelligence that resides within each one of us and connects us to the world. You know, it's not so much a causative thing, it's that everything's written everywhere. You know, and if we just approach the world with informed, reverent curiosity, this call and response, you know, and part of the description of now as we enter from the last realm of Pisces, which is everything that has ever inspired humans and maybe wolves to kinship and goodness. And in moments, really in moments, here it's very exciting, okay. But in moments, the sun will enter Aries, which is the realm of Mars. So beneath everybody's chair is an invisible gift package full of all kinds of invisible magic tools that we've always had, you know, like Dorothy's slippers. You know, we've always had these things. We don't need more powers, but to use the considerable powers with which we've been bestowed, power of language, power of storytelling. But I like to say we all have, in your invisible imaginary gift package beneath your seat, a magic mirror, you know, which is, you know, a crucial part of all of us as we become ever increasingly influential storytellers. Because whatever we speak to in another is the part of them we're inviting to dance with the corresponding part of ourselves, which is why we want to discern. Yes, we like dia-gnosis, because diagnosis, dia means everywhere, gnosis is wisdom. You know, so we want to diagnose but not judge. Because when we judge another, we want to discern the difference between discernment and judging. We're inviting the least evolved part of them to dance with the least evolved part of us, and it's just never pretty. You know, so I am your agent, you know, on the banks of the Potomac River outside, just upstream from Washington, D.C. You know, I'm happy to waft magic down the river for you. It's part of my assignment. But I, on your behalf, really, I go to the underworld known as conservative political action conferences and hang out with right-wingers. That's my social life in Washington on your behalf. But I live with a coyote longer than I've lived with a human, so it's a mysterious life. But in that realm right now, you know, we pass the baton, you know, so the magic mirror says, each one of us, we hold up a mirror to the world, right? And go, look, it sucks in detail, right? Which is important first diagnostic tool. And then the trickster within all of us, with a wave of the hand, turns the mirror into a window, but look how beautiful it could be. And then what happens in about 20 minutes, we with another wave of the hand, trickster coyote part of all of us, you know, waves hand and turns the window into a door, let's go. So we're right at this moment, right now, backstage to onstage, you know, from dreaming, conjuring, conferring into let's go, you know. So mirror, window, door. And it's part of all of our dynamic to critique and bless. We say critique without vision is complicitous with dominance. You know, you go, hey, that's the mirror part. You come back here, where's the window and the door? And it's crucial, again, as we head out into this, it's dangerous, you know, but danger and beauty always are intertwined in our evolutionary dynamic. But right now, you know, the realm of Pisces, where Venus exalted and Neptune and Ceres and Chiron, little planetary beings, and Mercury all in Pisces, coolest time ever to be a Pisces. You know, enough of the tragic romantic melancholy, can't afford that anymore. Better a trickster than a martyr, says Coyote. And see, it's the same dynamic. It's without a magical life, you know, we're doomed. But with magic, a willingness to cooperate with everything, we can pull it off. So we're right also equinox into lunar eclipse, you know, the partner of the solar eclipse. Everything loves to be literal and symbolic as a form of personal magic. You know, everything, you know, cooperators are standing by. So what happens with a lunar eclipse, which in California, you know, again, here, well, I happen to be here now. In California, you know, on Tuesday morning at 5 a.m., we'll get a glimpse of the moon setting in the west, eclipsed. And so we can have eclipses on this planet because we're the only planet we know of where the sun and moon are the exact same size. You know, in about a couple hundred thousand years, we won't have them because the moon's moving further away. But equality, you know, is here. So a lunar eclipse is a precise full moon. It's where the sun, earth, moon are lined up. So the sun projects the earth's shadow onto the moon. We see shadow. So for 25,000 years, humans have used this. You know, what would we like to have eclipsed by what? So I like saying, may the hubris of humanism, you know, be eclipsed by the truth of animism. You know, everything's alive. And we're not going to, you know, get ourselves out of this pickle by ourselves. It's by ourselves that got us into this thing. It's only by a willingness to collaborate with the ingenuity of plants and animals and creatures and everything alive that we're going to pull this thing off. Democratic animism. You know, and I do love things that I carry with me, you know, these important fragments of conversation. Lakota Sioux Elder years ago on the radio, we were talking about coyotes because I'd just gotten Stella, this experimental between worlds person, half dog, half coyote. And the Lakota elder was saying coyote's so smart. And he said, you know, we the Lakota didn't hunt alone. You know, every so often, those gifted at trance would go into a reverie and would broker a deal with the wolves and coyotes, and we would all hunt together for a season. And if you want to destroy a culture, you shame them out of their best parts, you know, and you shame them out of their capacity to collaborate across borders, you know, and you call them that's not intellectual, you know. Again, this is all a form of sneaky colonialism, so sneaky in so many intriguing ways. And so, you know, let's think that all of us, in a sense, can remember that in our bones and the mythological DNA in our blood, that we know how to go backstage into a reverie and a trance and emerge going, all right, it wasn't easy, but the coyotes want the front left leg and half the liver of every other deer. The wolves are cool with that, and the deer are cool with that. All right, everybody back on stage. You know, democratic animism. You know, and when it goes with my friend Robinette Kennedy, who is, you know, her cover is a psychologist, good cover. Everybody's got a cover, no matter how radical one's title. We've all been in witness relocation programs until now. It's the great tide of all that has been exiled but that is beautiful rising back up on this equinox tide. You know, come on in. Our word sacred means disobedient. Outside Greek and Roman villages were signs that said, if you go past this sign, you are saker. You are outside conventional bounds, and we don't recommend it. So to be sacred was an act of defiance of the community. I'm going to climb the sacred mountain. They told me not to. But then to return, you know, you will go far, but be sure to come back, says the fortune cookie, right? And to come back to enrich the community. So all of us, sacred beings, defiant, heretics. Remember, heretic was a term of honorific in early Christianity. You go, boy, that Diana sure is a heretic, because it means free thinker, right? So all heretics, you know, who voyaged forth, now it's olly-olly income free. Everybody come on in. You know, a great sacred tide of irresistible invitation to a guiding, all-inclusive story. And we go, yeah, let's go for that thing. And whatever the next thing I was going to say was. So this is this powerful time when all the myths are really speaking to us. You know, everything's rooting for us. Oh, I know. Yes, Robinette Kennedy. Right. Thank you, mind. So Robinette, who's spicy and provocative in an earned, informed way, she said, "What if the idea of matriarchy is a patriarchal concept?" And we go, "Ooh, that's fun. That's fun. Now we're cooking." She said, "As opposed to actual equality." Actual equality would look like matriarchy, you know, getting it back into balance, which is what the equinox is about. So she lives in Crete, you know, she's a scholar of Malta, you know, and so that's a fun thing. But she said, you know, the modern concept of worship is so degraded and so full of a kind of empire supplication. You know, Jesus never used the word Lord, right? That's all way late when the originating liberating teachings were kidnapped into servitude to the state by Paul, who was called the early Karl Rove. And so if you cook it back to its, cooking everything back to its originating impulse before it got colonized, all language back etymologically. You know, we say everything into the lunar eclipse cauldron, no teaching so sacred that it shouldn't be thrown in, going, is it equal? Is it equal Mars and Venus? Is it equal man and woman? Is it equal humans and the rest of creatures on this planet? You know, can the truth be said without fear? Is the trickster welcome? Okay, we ladle it out? No, we throw it back in for another round of ladling. You know, and so Robinette said it's so full of supplication and kind of colonialism masquerading as spirituality. And she said in ancient cultures and throughout the Mediterranean, there was great reverence and respect between the onstage sensual world of fur and mangoes and incarnational reality and the backstage invisible spiritual world. Great respect. But it was much more collaborative, she said. The invisible divine seeks incarnational invitation as much as we seek communion with it. And I go, I love that. As long as we have a hierarchical spirituality, we're going to get Dick Cheney, right? So, you know, so again, this idea of democratic animism, true equality teased in. You know, this is not so much about Buddhist transcendence, although all spiritual traditions are called now into pragmatic mysticism. You know, does it make the world better? You know, we love, you know, Tibetan Buddhism and its exquisite form of visualization, but again, you know, forms of spirituality have always often been tolerated or exiled by empire, but the lives of actual Tibetans, 14th century feudalism, you know, in terms of actual reality, so all traditions now going, does it make the world better for everything, for the chipmunk, for the ant, for the badger? You know, great fairy tale people say, you know, one form of fairy tale is careful, reverent living in a particular place, this tree, this badger, this thing, the restoration of intimacy to the world. So here we are for that dynamic, and just a little bit of the ancient, the myths that are kind of pouring in. The Mabinogion, Welsh kind of Arthurian legends, very powerful stories collected in 10th century, but much, much older. And there's a moment in the Mabinogion when the elders get together and go, uh-oh, the men just found out they have something to do with children, and things were going so well before this. But we can see it's going to get awkward, you know, that men will get possessive of children, you know, and women will become property, and humans will set forth on this individual path until they lose kinship not only with each other but with nature herself, until the earth herself might die. They're sending it to us. And they said, and then at that point, there will be some humans who keep all the value of their individual journey, but once again, expand back into telepathic communion and kinship. They wrote that to us. They're pitching it to us. So again, you know, the cooperators are standing by. It's all a collaborative dynamic. You know, so again, part of the dynamic is inviting in and then animating. So we're right at this moment of the vision, the myth, everything that's ever moved humans to kinship, the beautiful music, everybody's presentations, the great conversations here, you know, all synchronous into action, into the realm of Aries, which is Mars, which is animals. You know, Mars is energy, desire, eroticism, fuel, the energy we run on symbolically, which is why, you know, the nature of, you know, when we run on, you know, if progressives could quit their addiction to righteous finger-wagging disappointment, boy, we really have some energy back. So that realm about, you know, to discourage the bad but encourage the good. So many people were like, oh, I'm so disappointed in Obama. And we go, well, first, do you know that disappointed means I am powerless in the underworld, so let's quit bespelling ourselves with the power of language, you know, and come up with some other language. You know, we want language as, you know, as diverse as the creation we seek to, you know, to honor. We want linguistic biogenesis, metaphoric biogenesis. You know, talking to Rick Gallo, one of the great deep ocean scientists, you know, after the ongoing Gulf ecocide, there was a great TEDx conference of the world's leading ocean scientists, and they were weeping. They were weeping. Which is like a tarot card, right? Knowledge no longer divorced from feeling. But Rick Gallo was a great radio guest because he guided us to the deep oceans and said, yes, we are humans, we are messing it up, but never forget that at the bottom of the oceans are these deep vents, you know, blowing new life into the world all the time, biogenesis. So again, we want our linguistic biogenesis, our metaphoric biogenesis, you know, the words. People say, how long will we be fighting? And I go, as long as we keep using that metaphor. There's so many other words, you know, and, you know, everything into the cauldron, everything wants to be tossed into the cauldron to be ladled out, but it's where we put tired language. You know, so many of our team, again, say, we really want to have an impact. And it's like, really, a short, violent encounter? Are you sure? Would you, how about an eternal curvy influence, you know? You know, just again, you know, Jornus Trickster says, we don't really care what you humans do. We care the manner in which you do it, that it be from freedom and choice. So we can use the word fight, but with full awareness that our brains are metaphoric. And whenever we use the word fight, it downloads aggression. You know, as John Michael Greer, a great informed druid, says, you know, if you want people to get nothing done but conflict in an already too hot world, convince them they're on one side of something. You will only get heat. You know, what two needs is three, which is the unifying story. So to call it in, we call in the unifying story again that includes everyone. So it is this powerful and beautiful moment of transition. You know, as we step out, you know, out there, you'll see the moon in Leo, the power of sacred theater overhead right next to Jupiter in Virgo, which is the power of medicine stories, remembering, you know, again, who brought what. We've all brought the sum of our beautiful failures and advances and achievements brewed into opportunity. We say by gathering here like now, inner dedication magnetizes outward opportunity. So this is just a little bit of what I have to say. I'll be saying more tomorrow at 4 at Commonweal, and also on Tuesday night, and many ways to play, because it is the time for metaphysics and what we call politics. You know, our word idiot comes from Greek idiotus, which meant one who was so ignorant as to be willfully disengaged from collective well-being, right? So people are sometimes allergic to the word politics. So we go, well, let's throw it into the cauldron and just ladle out dedication to collective well-being, because that's really what it means as we're electing flora and fauna. You know, but it is the time to be influential. And you know, there is great danger out there brewing, because the very worst of humans is being invited, you know, to the surface. So it behooves all of us that sane reverence assume cultural narrative lead, you know, and that we all be able to invite the best out of everyone. You know, so maybe as our willingness to do that, we might go, all right, we are willing to cooperate with nature's evolutionary ingenuity, and we might just howl our offering together. Thank you, team.
Okay, we have an amazing gift next. It's Mary Evelyn Tucker reading from The Journey of the Universe. And earlier today, Wendy Johnson asked us to visualize those teachers and people who have done so much for us, and to find some way to say thank you to them. So from the bottom of my heart, Mary Evelyn, thank you. You were one of those people I thought of today. I'm so grateful for you and your work.
So Brooke is a graduate of the Yale Forestry School, so that's why we're tremendously proud of her. Well, it's a hard act to follow all of these wonderful presentations, and Brock's, reading, telling of the universe story. I'm going to tell Brian Swim on you. That was terrific. So I'm going to read part of the last chapter of this little book, Journey of the Universe, which took about 10 years to do, along with the film. And it's called The Emerging Earth Community. And I think it reflects why we're here, what each of your work is about, to suggest that we're part of a multicultural planetary civilization for the first time in human history. And this is really a thrill. It's hugely difficult to do, but we can do it because we are doing it. And you here in this extraordinary area, Bay Area, Marin area, fault area, geological fault area, are on the very, very front lines of some of the most amazing changes in our lifetime. So from the East Coast to the West Coast, I bring you all kinds of loving, loving wishes that the success of each one of your work will go forward with this emerging Earth community. Thank you. So this is written with my dear friend, Brian Swim. The challenge of conscious self-awareness is unlike anything that has occurred for millions of years. We are finding ourselves in the midst of a vast transition. How are we to respond? For we sense we are in a dark night. We dwell in unknowing and yet grope forward. The path is still unclear. With what shall we navigate? The path is uncertain because our sense of larger purpose and destiny is clouded. We are seeking patterns that connect us to a vaster destiny, a vital participation in Earth's unfolding. There is nothing more mysterious than destiny of a person, of our species, of our planet, or of the universe itself. But in the modern era, the question was considered unimportant compared with the practical necessities of commerce and trade. Our puzzlement regarding our destiny is especially poignant since everything else in the universe seems to have a role. The primeval fireball had the work of bringing forth stable matter. The stars had the work of creating the elements. The same is true on Earth. Each species has its unique role to play for the larger community. The phytoplanktons in the ocean fill the air with oxygen and thus enable every animal to breathe. That is their great work, to fill each lung with nourishing breath. But do we humans have such a role? With respect to the universe itself, is there a reason for our existence? Is there a great work required of us? Throughout the modern period, we have often been dissatisfied with the traditional answers concerning human destiny. Maybe this restlessness reveals something significant in our deep nature. Other species found their biome and settled into it, but nothing has seemed to satisfy us fully. Every place we went, we felt we were at home, yet not at home. Some urge carried us forward from place to place. Perhaps our destiny has something to do with this desire to journey and experience the depths of things. Perhaps that is why we are here, to drink so deeply of the powers of the universe, we become the human form of the universe, becoming not just nation-state people, but universe people, becoming a form of human being that is as natural to the universe as the stars or the oceans, knowing how we belong and where we belong so that we enhance the flourishing of the Earth community. Creativity and flourishing. Along with the stars and the ocean, which inspire us, I've just skipped a section, but what do we draw on? The stars and the ocean and creativity. We can consider what we make with our hands as a way to reflect on human destiny. Our urge to make things, to create things, is certainly as deep as the urge of the sun to shine and the earth to spin. Our destiny is woven into the mystery of creativity and time. For one of the most stunning discoveries in 20th century cosmology is the deep sense of time that the universe carries. This is not a mechanical time, but a cosmological time of universe emergence. In some remarkable way, the universe seems to be similar to the unfolding of a giant red oak, where one stage of development leads to the next, as when the galaxies begin to form several hundred million years after the birth of the universe. It was not possible for galaxies to merge earlier or later. If any galaxy started to appear in the first 100,000 years, they would have been torn apart instantly. The energy conditions and patterns of organization necessary for such a magnificent feat were present then and only then. And with the galaxies in a stable form, it was suddenly possible for second and higher generation stars with planets to form. These solar systems could not have formed in an earlier era. It is the same with our moment. We are in the midst of vast destruction, but it is simultaneously a moment of profound creativity. We are involved with building a new era of Earth's life. Our human role is to deepen our consciousness in resonance with the dynamics of the 14 billion year creative event in which we find ourselves. Our challenge now is to construct livable cities and to cultivate healthy foods in ways congruent with Earth's processes. Our role is to provide the hands and hearts that will enable the universe's energies to come forth in a new order of well-being. Our destiny is to bring forth a planetary civilization that is both culturally diverse and locally vibrant, a multiform civilization that will enable life and humanity to flourish. The conclusion is the enveloping powers. Because we know that life is an adventure involving both chaos and order, we sometimes want desperately to control things. And whenever our fear grows too strong, we become vulnerable to simplistic promises concerning the future. But no one knows what the future holds. All of that is hidden in the darkest night. The future is being created by all of us, and it is a messy and confusing process. What is needed is courage to live in the midst of the ambiguities of this moment without drawing back into fear and a compulsion to control. Are there guarantees? No, none. But there are reasons for confidence. When the universe was just quarks and leptons, could anyone have known that it was in the process of bringing forth stars and galaxies? Or later, when Earth emerged and life existed in the form of tiny, jiggling cells, could anyone have seen in them the possibilities of the bluefin tuna or a vast temperate rainforest? We find ourselves inside an amazing drama, filled with danger and risk, but also stunning creativity. This has happened many times in the past. 2 billion years ago, when the atmosphere became so filled with oxygen, all of life was deteriorating. The only way for the life of that time to survive was to burrow deep into the mud at the bottom of the oceans. The future of Earth seemed bleak. And yes, in the midst of that crisis, a new kind of cell emerged, one that was not destroyed by oxygen, but was in fact energized by it. Because of this miracle of creativity, life exploded with an exuberance never seen before. It is in the nature of the universe to move forward between great tensions, between dynamic opposing forces. If the creative energies in the heart of the universe succeeded so brilliantly in the past, we have reason to hope that such creativity will inspire us and guide us into the future. In this way, our own generativity becomes woven into the vibrant communities that constitute the vast symphony of the universe. Thank you.
So I am going to introduce Rick Bass, who is known to you from the panel this morning on climate change. He's going to be reading from The Larches of Yak. Rick, are you here?
Yes.
All right. As an employee of the Forest Service, I have to say, Rick, that when you said that we were clear cutting in your forest, I was very disturbed by that. And I have the deputy chief of the Forest Service on my speed dial. My email address is sdunsky@fs.fed.us. So send me an email. All right? Mr. Rick Bass.
Yeah, Steve's got the chief on his speed dial, and we have Steve on our speed dial. So we have the chief on our speed dial. Can y'all hear me in the back? Thanks for that gorgeous music, y'all. I was going to read about larch up in the Yak, which is like redwood. It's amazing deciduous conifer. It's just this crazy species, but there's not enough time to talk about it. Something we didn't talk about a lot today at this tree conference, and understandably, was animals, which, you know, come out of the trees. We talked a little bit about jaguars and salmon and murrelets, and that's about it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about wolves tonight really quickly, and thank you, Betsy and Osprey, for y'all's comments this conference and tonight also. I don't have a title for this piece, but I guess I would call it A Wolf Equals a Willow Tree. There is color in the land again. Or perhaps the color was always there, like a pigment in the soil, but was simply rendered imperceptible for a while. But not for long. Not all that much separated the land, famous already for the mineral-rich hues of Yellowstone's cliffs and mountains, its gurgling hot springs and bubbling mud pots. In terms of time or space, from the breath of the wolves that would bring the color back, like painters. I forgot that music tonight, like, there's five senses, right? And that's how we're going to win this battle, for lack of a better word, sorry to use a military term, but this campaign, this effort, this goal, this vision, we're going to win it with the five senses. And the most primal of them is sound. Every other sense we reprocess and repackage into our neurology. There's a central processing unit in our brain, like we take vision, and it comes through the optic nerve, and we tweak it and then put it into our brain, and we see stuff. But music is the only thing that comes in straight into the brain like a sponge, just comes straight in, unprocessed. So I wish y'all played a little longer before I came up here. But so I forgot where I was. The wolves, to the best of anyone's knowledge, had been extinguished from Yellowstone for only 7 decades, shot, trapped, poisoned, eradicated. In terms of space, only a veil of country had separated them, some 700 miles, more or less, Canada. Any one of the Yellowstone wolves, any one, could have covered that short distance in a week rather than taking the better part of a century. There is an increasing wealth of knowledge accruing around the recolonization of Yellowstone, but the recolorization of Yellowstone will always be wrapped in mystery. The wolves did not return on their own. It took a massive reversal of public sentiment and 160,000 letters to Congress before 14 wolves were finally captured up in British Columbia and transported to Yellowstone during 1994, where, after dramatic political maneuverings of lawsuit and countersuit, they were released into the snows of Yellowstone. An ocean of elk and buffalo awaited them. I think maybe they would have recolonized Yellowstone without human intervention. They were already beginning to ease back down across the border, filtering into Montana through places like the Yak and the Nine Mile. But the American public wanted them sooner. So we went out and got them and brought them here in trucks and helicopters, wrenched from their old homelands and with significant mortality. Not that a more natural recolonization would have been entirely seamless. Already, not one of those original recolonizers survives. Already, the last of the first returning or returned wolves have gone under, down into a soil that did not birth them, but which sustained them, and from which they summoned a seemingly miraculous flowering of wildness. There is color in the land again. How can the crimson blood of elk in the snow release a bluebird? How can black and silver wolves combine like pigment to unleash a new surge of yellow warblers and brilliant tanagers back into a landscape long absent such threads, such an abundance of color? Upon the wolves' return, so sudden was the transformation, so quick the reparations, that it seemed a marvel that the landscape, brittle and fractured as it had become in the absence of even that one species, had been able to hold together as well as it had for these 70 or so years. Not so much like a person across a similar span of years, living with some awful dose of toxins within, but more perhaps like that same person living with the absence of some stellar, sparkling, wondrous ingredient, some beautiful, shining, gleaming essence, perhaps read about in old medical texts and hypothesized, but never seen or known, only dreamed or imagined. In the 10 years since the wolves have been back, they have been reshaped, huge sections of an awkwardly leaning ecosystem, one which in many places we did not even recognize as leaning. And as if the landscapers held the key to renewing the building itself. Elk, the primary food for wolves, represent a substantial reserve of energy and nutrition on the hoof. By pruning the wildly excessive elk numbers and by forcing the elk to be elk again, the Yellowstone wolves kept the elk herds on the move, allowing overgrazed riparian areas to recover. The elk were no longer encamping in any one spot like feedlot animals, and the restored riverbank served as nesting and feeding habitat for songbirds of different hues. Blink and a howl equals the color yellow. Now the elk are not living as long, their trophic capacity, vessels of sunlight, vessels of grass meat, is being redistributed with greater alacrity, greater vitality throughout the Yellowstone. There is greater turnover in the mortality game upon which wild nature and what we think of as a healthier nature relies so powerfully. Where previously the overcrowded and static elk and deer herds conspired to keep stands of aspen from regenerating, browsing with sharp teeth at any and all young aspen suckers as soon as they emerged, the beautiful groves of aspen, snow-white bark, and quivering gold leaves in the fall are now prospering, flaring back up on the landscape like so many tens of thousands of autumn-lit candles. Entire mountain ranges are ultimately being painted anew, more color, more vitality, more light, by the arrival of, initially, a mated pair of wolves, an alpha male and female, followed by the next wave of other wolves, new wolves. Certainly the renewal of the aspen and of streamside deciduous trees that had previously been repressed by the overabundance of elk, willow, cottonwood, ninebark, chokecherry, is not limited to showcase only values of painterly aesthetics. As in all of wild nature, there is function everywhere, purpose, meaning, and a sophistication beyond our wildest dreams. Cerulean, sapphire, Bordeaux, jade, the return of deciduous saplings to the hoof-cut, denuded riverbanks once abused by too many elk has been good for more than songbirds and artists. Beavers, too, have prospered, able now to access their requisite building and feeding materials without needing to venture so far into dangerous territory. This has resulted in the return of more backwater ponds and pools and eddies, the filtering and life support systems for so much other river life, and provided a greater distribution of nutrients in the shallow sloughs that back up and create gentle floods behind the beaver dams. In these shallow areas of submersion, young cottonwoods prosper, more flame color and more beaver habitat. Circles within circles. With more beavers in the system, the wolves will eat a beaver now and again. Every X pounds of beaver meat consumed, displacing, I suppose, a similar poundage of what otherwise would have been elk meat. So that in the elk herds relinquishing their previously uncontested streamside territory, they gain a certain freedom and vitality. While an old way of looking at things might suggest that the elk were serving the wolves, it could be said that the elk were serving themselves as well. It's all more tangled and wonderful than we may ever know, and the best part is we can't really predict or manage or fully measure it. Much as we'd like to, we can't say that three beavers plus one wolf plus two elk, a songbird, seven aspen trees, and a 10,000-acre wildfire equals six beaver, four elk, five wolves, and no birds, any more than we can say that chartreuse equals magenta or aquamarine fuchsia. We can spend centuries trying to chase down and quantify these relationships, but in a wild and healthy landscape, there will always be vast quantities of unknown relationships and immeasurable consequences. Even with all of the science and learning available to us in this century, we have trouble viewing the land, really seeing it in anything but the broadest and most brilliant strokes of color. I do not think it is coincidental that such discoveries, such illuminations of interconnectedness, are emanating from the tableau of one of our largest and wildest remaining wildernesses. So significant is the degree of our not-yet knowledge, our unknowingness, that we could make major discoveries in any environment, no matter how fragmented and compromised that system might be. But it is in our last few big wild landscapes, I think, where the potential, the opportunity for discovery remains strongest and might be most easily or readily encountered. Like neither saviors nor infidels, but simply, or not so simply, like wolves, they returned to their home, bringing great color and breathing a life force that some, in an upside-down world, view as destructive. as if we have become so estranged that we can no longer really tell one from the other. In this regard, the wolves are instructors, and in this regard, we are watching them with fascination, with our senses as well as our returning knowledge, like hunters ourselves, re-engaged and keenly alert.
Our next speaker is Osprey Oriel Lake. She'll be speaking about voices from the Amazon rainforest, protecting and defending sacred systems of life. Osprey spoke on our climate panel earlier today.
Good evening, everyone. What a special day this has been, and a particularly beautiful evening as well. I can't see any of you. It's totally dark up here, but I know you're out there. I'm pretty sure you're out there. Okay. And I can't read my notes in the dark, so we'll see what happens. I've been on the road, actually, for the last few weeks, in the Amazon and some other meetings, and this has been a beautiful landing point in this community, and I wanted to thank you all because I feel very welcome here, and being able to share these stories is very important to the work itself. I think that one of the things that's happening, it's like an ecosystem. The healthiest way to revive an ecosystem is connect more of it to itself. And I think when we meet like this, it's like an ecosystem of energy and nodes of the ecosystem meeting, and it makes it healthy and healthier. And I feel healthier for being here, so thank you. So hopefully some slides are going to appear. I'm wanting to show you some of the beautiful images of the Amazonian women from Ecuador. And I was very fortunate to be able to be there for International Women's Day. This is something that was concocted when we were in Paris during the climate negotiations, where several organizations, including Amazon Watch and myself, really decided that it was very important to uplift the voices of women from the Amazon, who are very, very powerful, fierce in their dedication to protecting their territories. And so we decided we were going to meet on International Women's Day and bring international attention to protection of the Amazon rainforest. Little did we know that in January of this year, there would be a very significant, unfortunate action between the Ecuadorian government and Andes Petroleum, which is a Chinese company, signing a new contract in the Zapata and Sariaco territories, which are two areas that are super in biodiversity. These areas should definitely not be destroyed. They should be protected. And so the significance of the International Women's Day March took on a whole other level of power, because now we all were not only uniting around women protecting the Amazon, but particularly these two new oil contracts in these territories. And it was quite exciting because it started out with there being about 50 women who were going to come together to meet around protest to these oil contracts. And that's definitely not there. And, And so it ended up that over the course of a few weeks, first there was 50 women coming from the communities, then there was 100 women coming, then there was 150 women coming, then we heard there's 250 women coming. We had to raise funds for all these travel for these indigenous women. It ended up being about 500 women from across seven different nationalities of the Andoa, Ashwar, Kishwa, Shwar, Shiwar, Sapara, and Wairani women. And it's really quite extraordinary for them to come to Puyo, where we had the demonstration, the march, and forums and press conferences, because That's all of the women. That's the representatives from the seven nationalities. Right there. I'm not... Okay. Are you with me here? Okay. Okay, so I just wanted you to see the faces of these amazing, fierce, powerful women. These are Wairani women, and their territories have, a great deal of them have already been destroyed. And they came to warn all the other peoples, no, you do not want oil extraction. So we were there, and you know, we did not anticipate that, you know, we had already seen that International Women's Day would be a great day for a march, but we didn't know that these oil contracts were going to happen. So it just added this huge vibrancy of women coming out of the jungle. They came by foot sometimes for 3 days walking through the jungle. You know, you're thinking about 500 women here. It's totally different. We're talking about women having to be in canoes for 3 days, traveling by foot, carrying their babies on their backs. It's incredible. Or, you know, these small little airstrips in the middle of the jungle, flying by plane to get out. So this was a historic event. They'd never done this before, bringing these different seven different nationalities together. And there's this turning point. That is what I really want to convey to you, is that not only are we feeling it here in the global north, all over the world in the communities that we're working in, people are understanding that we are at the precipice. This is something that, as Diana was saying earlier, we're feeling in our bones, we're feeling in our very being. All over the world, people realize this is our moment. If we're going to do something, this is our moment. So it was really important that also the indigenous women there understood. We brought a small delegation with us. We brought Ponca Nation elder from Oklahoma, Casey Camp Hornet, with us. And we brought a delegation with us to be with them in their march and protest with them. And they were so excited to have international press that we brought and to really visibilize their struggle. Because as we've talked about earlier today, we are all connected. There is no border. The fact is that, as scientists have shown us, the Amazon rainforest is critical to us here in North America. There's something called the flying rivers. And there is moisture that the Amazon River produces in the atmosphere that comes here to North America that we depend upon for our weather patterns here. And so we created spiritually, scientifically, this acknowledgement between peoples that we women here in the global north need to really support our sisters in the global south. With our privilege, with our finances, with our security, as I mentioned earlier with Berta Caceres, you know, our lives are not on the line in the same way they are. And the women that we work with earlier last year in August, their lives were on the line, they were criminalized, they were beaten for peaceful protest against extraction in their territories. And so we can afford them safety, we can afford them funding. And I think it's really important that we understand that we're all connected and that we need to move between borders for our sacred Mother Earth and the living systems of our planet. And the women there were very, very strong with us in their demands in asking for our support. And the other thing that they really conveyed to us is their concept of the living forest that I mentioned earlier. And what they're doing in the Seriaca territory is they're planting beautiful flowers all around their territory to say, we want you to see that these flowers are our borderlands into the living forest, and everything within these borderlands, we want to respect the spirit of the plants. We want to respect the spirit and beings of the trees. We cannot live without them. They keep conveying to us this idea of how we cannot continue to live without the wisdom of these ancient forests and the spirit of these forests. They're also conveying to us their idea of Buen Vivir, or Sumak Kausai, which is this idea of the community of life and their cosmovision, that when we talk about community, we're talking about ecology, we're talking about economy, we're talking about our relationships with each other, our living relatives, and all time, all space, and that we really need to have a much broader worldview and a much broader understanding of what it means to be a human being within these living ecosystems. So their whole idea of Buen Vivir or Sumak Kausai is very important to all of us, and they're really conveying a much larger cosmovision. They're relaying concepts about our dreams and how we need to really pay attention to our dreams more and understand our intentionality of how we're living with each other and the earth. And I think one of the very important things also is, as you all know, and one of the reasons we're all meeting today, is that our basic foundational relationship with nature must change. And somehow, and I could riff on this for 20 hours, and I won't right now, historically, we have come into a crossroads of people in the modern world not understanding our deep connection to the natural world. And I think one of the reasons we're in this climate crisis, environmental and socio-ecological crisis, is that we have perceived that we have a disconnection from nature instead of understanding we are part and particle of nature. And a lot of things have stemmed from this that have been hugely detrimental to the human venture, the human adventure in life. And we need to really change that fundamental dream. We need to understand that we are the trees, the rivers, the mountains. These are our relatives. And this is something the Indigenous women are deeply trying to convey to us and to help them protect their territories from further destruction. And a big reason that they're in so much trouble is because of the modern concepts of economy, the modern concepts of capitalism, the modern concepts of disconnect from the natural world. I think I'll just close by saying that I was profoundly moved by being in Ecuador with these women. They brought me into ceremony with them. We were also able, during the time of the international march, the company, Andres Petroleum, actually tried to get into the Sapara territory to start their preparations for oil drilling right when we were having the march, because they knew so many of the leaders were in Poyo, not in their territories. And so a group of the Sapara people went out with a letter to the Andes Petroleum Company and went out to the airstrip and said, "We do not want you in your territory. We do not want you there. We do not want this. We did not consent to this." And we were able, through the power of the march and everything that happened, to get them to not go into the territories. And it's really important because there's something in international law called free, prior, informed consent. That is international law. It's law in Ecuador that says if the indigenous people do not consent, you cannot do this in their territories. And so there's a violation of indigenous rights. There's a violation of rights of nature, which is in the Constitution of Ecuador. So we actually have a real powerful legal case to stop this extraction of oil in these territories, and we were going to definitely follow through on all of these commitments to ensure that this does not happen. And I will leave by saying that the thing that really, really touched me when I was heading back to the United States is Gloria Oshiga, Patricia Galinga, these are our sisters in the Sapara and Sariaco territories, you know, met with me, and they just looked me in the eye and they grabbed my hands and said, "Do not forget us. Do not forget us, because we are here and we're putting our lives on the line, we're putting our bodies on the line, because if it comes down to it and the tanks come in from the government, we will die. We would rather die than lose our territories." And that, of course, just moved me, and of course the whole situation with Berta Cáceres, and for us to understand our privilege here in North America, to understand our opportunity, that we can speak freely without being threatened by our lives, that we can speak out for what we believe in, is something that we have the privilege of here. And of course, there's complexities here in North America, but it's nothing like they're facing in these countries. And I really do think it is our duty to understand that we are deeply interconnected with these forests in the Amazon, in the boreal forest. We also work in the DR Congo, as mentioned earlier, and that this is something that we actually can really do, support these indigenous peoples and understand that our survival and their survival is deeply intertwined. And, you know, I just want to share their fierceness, their courage and boldness with all of you. The earth, the fire, the water, the air, return, 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 return. The earth, the water, the fire, the air, return, 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 return. The earth, the water, the fire, the air, return, 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 return. The earth, the water, the fire, the air, return, 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 return. Thank you.